I felt just so helpless. I couldn't actually help these kids, and I probably shouldn't have been there in the first place. I was 24-year-old male with no child protection check and no background in social work and just a good heart, which is a good start, but it's certainly not enough, I think. There's a lot more to what I can do with my degree than just serve myself, essentially. In 2023, what I'm asking the question for is, are charities still fit for purpose in their current structure? Or has the world moved on? Do we need to reconceptualize what success looks like? When people think that you're a good person because of the work that you do helping people, that's a big problem. I'm Wei Yeo, and this is the Good People Podcast.
It's a tip of the cap, it's a pat on the back, it's a smile from ear to ear. They're the good people from round here.
Yes, welcome to another episode of the Good People Podcast. My name is Andy, and it's all brought to you by In Other Good News and recorded here in the In Other Good News studios. My guest today, he's a man, he's an international man, not so much of mystery, but he's been all over the world. He's doing some amazing things. He's a charity and social enterprise founder. He's a co-founder of another amazing organization, and now he's an author of a book. And we're going to tackle a topic today which I think will make you think. It's a great book. I've read the book, and I am right behind it. So I want to welcome to the podcast today, I've got Wei Yeo. Wei, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Andy. I really appreciate being here in this amazing studio and your hospitality.
Oh, well, we're having coffee, of course. So the In Other Good News coffee, iogn.com.au.
Do I have to make that noise every time I take a sip?
Yeah, you have
well?
To. You have to go, I've got something funny that is not related to this podcast at all, but I found out about you from a mutual friend.
Oh.
So I've heard that you have a big problem with people using your image for fake accounts on the internet. Yes. Is this true?
It is true.
So people take your image
and
then create a fake account.
Yes, because apparently my face from at least 8 years ago signifies trust.
Right.
So what happened was, it's just very random. So a friend of mine from high school days was looking up cleaning services in Sydney and looked at the reviews and then saw my face attached to a name, which is not mine. The name was Jason Chan. And then I thought that was pretty funny. And then my brother reverse Googled, image searched my name, and found my face on a lot more products, from welding to web services to all sorts of strange things and all sorts of different names as well. So we kind of traced it to one particular agency that thought they could use my face to promote, you know, to, when they're creating websites, to make fake reviews essentially. But it's pretty funny.
It is. It is funny. I've heard that you will occasionally post, found another one.
Yeah.
I found another one of me.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I don't have that problem. Maybe that's a compliment.
I think it's a compliment to that photo. But it's also pretty funny when friends are saying things like, you know, we're not interested in what Wei Yeo thinks. We want to hear what Jason Chan thinks instead. Like, all right, I get it.
You're not good enough for your own image.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, so, that's disappointing. Yeah. I think it's funny. But I think what's not funny is the path that you've taken with the charity sector, which is what we've got. So we've got your book here that we're going to talk about. But I thought before we talk about this, because you're a charity founder, OIC Cambodia and Australia, actually, they're very closely connected. We'll talk about what those are in a moment. A lot of people think of Cambodia and charity, actually. I know a lot of people have actually done that. Other people in this podcast have mentioned Cambodia and charity. And the mutual friend also, I believe, you crossed paths with in Cambodia for charity. Yeah, that's our friend Jojo. Thanks for tuning in, Jojo. You created a charity, but after a series of events. What I want to do is skip back to your history, your family, and this will give our listeners here an insight into how you got there. So Can we go right back to the immigration side of things?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you're an immigrant. Tell us about your family.
Yeah.
And so, coming to Australia.
Yeah, I mean, me being here in Melbourne is sort of a miracle, really, and just a lot of sacrifices to make it to this point. So my great-grandparents are from China, and they escaped China during a time of famine. They moved to Malaysia. And then my parents actually came to Australia as students in the late 60s, early 70s, when, by the way, the White Australia policy still existed. And they studied at university here because they were discriminated against in Malaysia being ethnically Chinese. And my mum, for example, did very well in school, topped her school, but couldn't get into the university of choice in Malaysia because of her race. And then they came to Australia and the White Australia policy ended and they decided to stay here in Australia and live a life that really is like a lot more humble and down to earth than what it would have been in Malaysia. Because when you have a Western education in a country like Malaysia, you can afford drivers and cleaners and cooks. And it's a very different, but I would say also quite artificial life. And so I think I always grew up knowing a lot about that sacrifice. And then, of course, the privilege that I've experienced being born in this country and raised in Australia and having access to things that my parents never had. And one of these things that we touched on is, you know, healthcare, for example, that's been a lot of my work. So I have a condition called ankylosing spondylitis. It's an autoimmune disease. It's arthritic. And as a result, in order to control this condition, where at times it's been so bad that I haven't been able to walk in the mornings due to pain and so on. And now, you know, I'm a very active person. In order to control it, I take monthly injections into my tummy that cost me $35 and cost the government $1,800
right.
every time I do this.
And so it's every month?
Every month.
Yep.
Every month, yeah. And I've lived in Cambodia for 5 years and China for a couple of years. And every time I lived overseas, I'd have to carry in a cooler bag 6 injections across there because it was funded by Medicare. And if I was to try and get this injection in those countries, it would cost me about 10 to 12 grand of,
wow,
you know, every batch of 6.
Yep.
So I think this really taught me the privilege that I've had being in this country and not to take it for granted.
Yeah. I think privilege is a challenge when you don't understand what it is and what it means. If you're experiencing privilege but you don't get it, it is a challenging thing. So I thank you for that story because I think that's a really great example of how we do have the privilege here. There's another part to this story, which is so your parents migrated here. You haven't described your family as being a very wealthy family, but you still managed to go to great schools. Yeah. And this, I like this story. Do you want to tell us how you managed to get into good schools?
So I'm the youngest of 3 boys. My eldest brother got a scholarship, a full academic scholarship to a very fancy private school in Sydney. My second brother, equally brilliant, managed to do the same. And then it sort of came to me and it was pretty much a given by this stage. But the other part of the story is my eldest brother went on to be not just a doctor, but also a surgeon.
Yep.
And so the joke in my family is that when your eldest sibling becomes a surgeon,
yep,
the parents look at the other two and they're like, yeah, whatever. It doesn't matter. You know, we've achieved what we need to achieve as Asian parents and what you guys do with your life is kind of inconsequential. So
we've got one.
Yeah, exactly.
What TER score did your brother get?
Oh, yeah. So my eldest brother got a TER in year 12 of 100, which means that he's in the top, I think it was 20 or 16 in the state or something like that. And then by the by, my second brother, who tried very hard not to be like my eldest brother, and didn't study as hard as he probably could, still, despite fluffing his way through, managed to get 99.85.
So, I mean, you know, they've set the standard high for you, but I guess they've done the work because they managed to help you get into a great school.
That's true.
I like this part of the story because it means that you've been able to achieve this without having to necessarily come from money or wealth in order to pay to get there, and 3 intelligent people have come through on the other side.
Well, my dad had $100 in his pocket when he arrived in Australia. So it is really one of those really amazing immigration stories that has, you know, is the backbone of Australia. So I don't think we should take these stories for granted. They're actually very special, but also quite common.
Yeah. Okay. So you managed to get into uni. What did you study at uni?
Physiotherapy.
And are you a good physio, do you think?
the opening chapter of the book details that I'm not a good physio. And I studied physiotherapy because I thought I would be, you know, physio to the stars, and not the Melbourne Stars, by the way, the Australian cricket team or the Wallabies or something like that. That
like was a high-profile physio.
High-profile, you know, driving a nice sports car,
yep.
Lots of clinics. And I realized one day when I was doing physio, I was actually treating this guy whose name was John, and he had a stroke. And on day one, he couldn't sit independently.
Right.
And on 5 weeks of treating him, day 25, he was walking down the corridor by himself. And to me, that was a big light bulb moment of, okay, there's a lot more to what I can do with my degree than just serve myself, essentially. And it was a real moment to wake up and see, you know, that helping people was really fulfilling. But also at the same time, that wasn't me. Doing that one-on-one deep work, which clinicians do day in, day out, and I really respect, it's just not me.
Wasn't for you. So then you got through your physio but thought, maybe this is not necessarily for me. So what happens then to lead you to doing an OIC Cambodia is speech pathology based. Mm. How do you get to speech pathology from physio?
So first of all, I think sometimes in life you have to have a really low moment before you can have a moment of clarity.
Mm.
And it was for me when I was in Sydney after 2 years of working as a physio, I was driving to work one day and I had this thought flash in my head that, wouldn't it be great if I swerved into oncoming traffic? Because that would mean that something interesting would happen in my life.
Mm.
And it was this really dark moment of like, okay, I need to do something about how empty my world is. And I did something that was very cliched in retrospect, which was pack up all my things, put them in storage and travel for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I learned a lot about the world and a lot about, again, my privilege and my place in the world. But also I learned about the fact that essentially, good intentions are not enough, because I volunteered in an orphanage in Vietnam for 6 months, and it was during a period where they had a typhoon that lifted the roof off this orphanage, and I felt just so helpless. I couldn't actually help these kids, and I probably shouldn't have been there in the first place. I was 24-year-old male with no child protection check and no background in social work and just a good heart, which is a good start, but it's certainly not enough, I think. And so then I came back to Australia and I studied an international development master's course, and then I worked for a small charity. Then I went back out into the world as a physiotherapy advisor for a big charity in China.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I kind of learned a little bit more about this cycle of dependence, this hamster wheel that charities place themselves on, where they are often caught up in justifying their own existence. And that's a lot of energy that goes into charities, which I'm sure we'll touch on.
Yeah.
And then I ended up in Cambodia, and that's when I discovered that people had known about this issue, which is lack of speech therapy, for a long time. And there was physiotherapy, which is my profession. There was psychology and social work and so on, but just a big gap. And I realized that I had to do something about it.
So you wanted to tackle speech pathology. And how many speech pathologists did they have in Cambodia?
Zero. So no university-trained speech therapists, over 500,000 people need it, millions more, you know, in the future will need it. And it's just such a patently obvious thing that was holding the country back. And there are arguments that go beyond the, you know, human rights arguments. There's economic arguments in terms of every dollar spent returns more money because of the participation in workforce. Yeah, and I guess it was also this moment of like, not all causes are created equal, which we kind of know. You know, some causes get more attention than others, but some get really nothing.
There are conversations I've had on this podcast with people about through various layers of charity, and some talking about small charities, how hard it is to achieve funding because the big charities are just so good at it. They have people whose job is to get funding. So they are a mechanism, like they're a machine, they're a fundraising generating machine. So it's very hard for a small charity to achieve the funding, right? Like that makes it really hard.
Yeah.
So with the big charities though, and you're talking about justifying your existence, when you've got a cause that you can see a need for, I mean, the common thing is for someone to go, all right, I'm going to give them money so that they can do a thing or whatever it is, but it's not always the answer, right? Like, that's not the reason why you should start a charity. And I think this is where we're getting to sort of the crux of the book.
Yeah, well, you mentioned the larger charities. So the statistics show that in Australia, half of the available funding goes to the top 0.4% of charities.
Right.
So the analogy I use is it's kind of like a pack of lions, and you've got these alpha lions that are over-consuming the resources that are available rather than nurturing the young cubs to continue on.
Mm.
And you're right, though, that, you know, simply seeing a issue that needs to be addressed is not anywhere near enough in terms of starting a charity. And a lot of my argument really is about starting with the end in mind.
Mm.
And maybe also thinking a little bit about what's the role of a charity. So I think our perception of charities and what they do is still quite old-fashioned. And charities have been around for centuries, of course. But in 2023, what I'm asking the question for is, are charities still fit for purpose in their current structure? Or has the world moved on? Do we need to reconceptualize what success looks like?
Mm.
So I think the traditional view of charities to break down is just input X, output Y. You know, you give me X amount of resources and I will affect Y amount of people, or, you know, get Y amount of girls to go to school, or prevent Y amount of deaths. And these are all very valid and admirable things to try and achieve, but it's quite a limited view of what charities should and could do.
Mm.
In the research that I did for this book, and I studied and talked to a number of charities, what they're actually doing is input X to catalyze change Y. So it's not about the output of Y. They don't have to be the ones to deliver that change, but they can often create the change or create the state in which the change can occur.
Mm.
So they can hand off the work to be done by, let's say, the government, private sector, or maybe they just finish the job so it doesn't have to be done at all.
Mm.
But the main thing is it's not the charity actually doing the work, and that's because charities' resources are so limited in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. So they're struggling for resources and they're trying to do it all. There's a lot of people who volunteer in charities are very... They're the empaths.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people who will give a lot,
yeah,
and they'll probably just keep giving a lot, which is kind of the hamster wheel idea, isn't it? That you just keep giving, but you don't actually ever achieve a result apart from an immediate Band-Aid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think the key question is, when are we going to stop doing this particular piece of work? So, And also, how do we know that the problem is solved? You know, and why is it that we have these problems which seem endemic and we have lots of charities? You know, we have way too many charities in Australia. That's a different topic. But we have so many charities working on this issue, but the problem doesn't seem to get better. And I think that's because the charities are often addressing the symptoms rather than solving the problem. And they're two very different things. So using the physiotherapy analogy, you can go to a physio and they can address your symptoms by giving you ice or massage and you walk out of there and you feel really great, but the problem's not really solved. You're coming back the next week and the week after. But the problem is solved when they give you the exercises or the advice to help you address that root cause issue. And you know the problem's solved when you don't need to come back.
Yeah.
And the physio has basically made themselves redundant. So let's stretch that analogy to charities. Why is it that charities are doing the symptom addressing work week in, week out? And why is it that so few charities are actually making themselves redundant? And I think if we had more charities that were working in that way, we'd be much more effective as a sector.
Yeah. There's a few big factors, I think. I did touch on this just before we started recording. People are employed to do these jobs. They don't want to lose jobs. That's a big one, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Like once you're employed, you know, and it's probably a feel-good job as well. Like it's a job that you would feel good about doing. Knowing that the idea would be that you don't have a job if the charity is successful would be alarming for people, wouldn't it?
That's right. So let's say, for example, we identify a cause like education in Malawi and we decide that we're going to do something about it. And what we do is we register a charity. Immediately, there's something that's harder to unwind because we've created a structure that will need to be unwound.
Yep.
And then we start
like
to...
Like the actual business. To,
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then the next thing is, as you mentioned, we start paying ourselves through some funds that we've acquired. Again, that's another thing that we're going to have to unwind if we're going to make ourselves redundant.
Mm.
So this just builds up and up and up. And when you get the larger charities, there's sort of too much at stake now for us to even think about shutting down or making ourselves redundant. And unfortunately, that's counterintuitive to solving the problem. again, if we're going to solve the problem, we're going to have to get to a point where we as the charity make ourselves redundant. But the more structures and the more layers we have, the harder and harder it is to do that.
And actually turn it off again. Yeah, okay. And then, of course, like we say, like no one likes the idea that they're going to lose their job as a result. So that's a big one. There's another big one as well. You've really opened my eyes with this book. I really enjoyed it. The Emma and Tom example, which touches a bit on people and their identity around the charity. My identity is the charity I created. That could be a difficult one to separate as well, right?
Yeah.
I said Emma and Tom's. I mean Tom's.
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 Tom's shoes.
Shoes, yeah. Not the juice. Just for the listeners out there, I'm not talking about the juice.
Just for
I'm
the lawyers.
Tom's shoes, yeah.
Yeah, so Tom's shoes, the model is you buy a pair of shoes in the store and they give a pair of shoes to someone in a poor country. And the founder of Tom's said, Blake McCoskey said, I want to give shoes for the rest of my life. This is my life purpose. And there was a very interesting comment made about that, which was in order for him to give shoes for the rest of his life, people have to be without shoes for the rest of their life. And it's a great comment because, again, there's that symptom addressing versus problem solving dilemma. Wouldn't it be better if actually the founder of Tom's doesn't need to exist? Sorry, doesn't need to give shoes. I mean, not as a person, but that his cause is actually solved once and for all.
Yeah.
And Tom's is a really good example because the giving of shoes for free in poor countries actually kills private sector, right? Private sector in those countries cannot compete with free goods that are shipped from overseas. The alternative would be to build up private sector so that they can feed themselves. You know, let's build up this industry so that they have an industry that's sustainable.
And make their own shoes.
Exactly. But that doesn't sell as well as the buy one, give one.
Give one, yeah. And I have to admit, until I read the book and that you put that example up, I always thought of it as such a great model. Like I thought, that's fantastic. And it's easy to sell. It's easy to explain to people and what you do and how you do it. But it does make a lot more sense that Tom's maybe should have set up so that it was buy a pair of shoes and we help train the people to... or whatever it is, you know, to make the shoes for the people in those, and if it's shoes that they actually need.
Yeah. I think a lot of the really catchy ideas just require a little bit more critical thought. But that's not, like, I definitely wouldn't blame you, Andy. I think it's really up to the charities that have this inherent knowledge to be self-aware enough that they should be educating people on what good models of charity work are. Unfortunately, I do see that a lot of charities really go lowest common denominator. They go for the things that they know are going to sell and they're going to fundraise, but they don't actually help the people that they're set out to help in the first place.
Also, a lot of the, when we talk about funding and things, a huge percentage of the money never even gets there. That's another big problem, right? Like it's only a very small amount through a big wheel that can actually get to the cause in the first place, right? So.
Well, I think that's a valid question, and I think that can even that concept can be addressed through having an end date, because if you have an end date, you're not set up for all perpetuity. You know, by saying, for example, the charity that we set up in Cambodia, OIC Cambodia, which is addressing speech therapy, we say that this charity will shut down in 2030, and it will shut down when we have 100 speech therapists that are employed by the government. Now, 100 is nowhere near enough.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like a big number, yeah.
No.
How many do they need in Cambodia?
Over 6,000.
Right.
Yeah. But what the theory is that if we take the country from 0 to 100, which is a lot harder than 100 to 6,000 as a, you know, as an effort, and we create the environment through which the sector can grow the number of speech therapists themselves by stimulating demand, by having government policy, by having a university course, setting up those roots in those countries, in this country.
The foundations for the production of speech therapists.
Yeah. Then we'll have done our job and we can exit and we don't need to do the whole job. And that means that the Cambodian government, the Cambodian society owns the solution for themselves and they take it from 100 to 6,000 themselves.
Yeah. And is that hard? Because we'll touch on this in a moment, but is it hard for you as someone who set that up or, you know, created that to be able to let that go and walk away?
Absolutely. And your ego is a big part of this sector. And ego is part of many sectors, by the way, so I don't think we're alone. But when people think that you're a good person because of the work that you do helping people, that's a big problem. And there's this concept called moral self-licensing that I talk about in the book, which is basically this idea that they found Prius drivers back in the day when Prius was a bigger thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would argue Tesla drivers probably, but we can get to that. They found that Prius drivers who thought that they were doing a good thing by driving a, you know, ethical, environmentally conscious car actually drove less ethically and drove more aggressively.
Oh, then their attitude on the road.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Yeah, so they stopped less at, pedestrian crossings. They cut more corners. They cut more red lights, etc. So the concept is that, when you do something or when perhaps your job is something that suggests that you're a good person, you're like, well, that's enough. I don't need to behave ethically in other avenues of my life.
Oh.
And I think the same thing can happen in charities. You have charity founders that actually are not really good people. They, they're very aggressive about the way in which their charity has to dominate a certain sector, and they're aggressive in the way they want to have market share, which is a really horrible term to use in charities, but that's often the view.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think ego is a big part of it, and disassociating your identity from the charity is really important as well. And I certainly faced that struggle when I set up this charity in Cambodia.
Have you managed to separate yourself from it?
So there were three short-term measures that I found to separate identity. And they're basically three things that I found I could do where my status as a charity founder didn't matter.
Uh-huh.
So the three things were being around kids. So my nephews and nieces playing with kids where they don't care what awards I've got or what the status of the charity is.
Mm.
The second is being in nature. Again, nature doesn't care who you are or what you've done, what your LinkedIn profile looks like.
Yep.
And the third is playing team sport. Again, when you're on the, for me, I played touch football. When you're on the touch football field, again, your status and how many likes you get on LinkedIn doesn't matter.
Yeah, that's right.
So I think these are easy ways in which to disassociate, but longer term ways are to make sure that you have interests outside your work and to make sure that your identity, isn't just your work. And it could be, musician, guitar player or whatever it is, but you have other avenues.
Also, that starting with the end in mind is a big one, right? Like, because that if the goal, and it's repeated regularly, our goal is to be finished this at this point, that's going to immediately make it easier for you to be saying, well, it's not about me, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's about the work. It's not about me. And I think that's something that we've been able to do really well with our work in Cambodia, because it's about this goal that we're laser focused on. And it's not about the celebrity founder, not that I'm a celebrity, but it's not about needing to push the founder forward as the face of this work.
A question I posed to Dave McNamara of Food Bank recently was the idea that it's not about me is a really great foundation, like it's a great value to have. But inherently, if you're the CEO or the founder of an organization, you are the person that people want to talk to.
Mm.
So they reach out to you because you started it. So you are thrown into a role where it is about you, because you get rewarded socially if your charity does well, or punished for certain things. But you are the person that they want to talk to. So it does feel like it's a very natural thing for the founders to be in the spotlight, right?
Absolutely. So what I found in Cambodia is people would listen to my advice and they would take it as gospel.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes I'd say things that even I wasn't sure about, but people would sort of nod their heads and be like, that's very insightful. And I came down with four reasons why my views were paid attention to in Cambodia. One, male, patriarchal society. Two, foreigner. It's still a society that's quite deferential to foreigners, unfortunately. Third, founder / boss. There's a lot of deference in terms of like hierarchy.
Mm.
And fourth, tall, because I'm 6 foot tall, which is reasonably tall in Australia, but gigantic in Cambodia. Now, if you break down these four things, none of these are reasons why my opinion is valid. It's not like I've got a PhD in development or any kind of, understanding of Cambodian politics or Cambodian healthcare. So what I realized was that in order for my opinion not to sway things in a direction that could potentially be false, I just had to be out of the room when these discussions were being made, and then eventually out of the country. So after 4 years of starting this charity, I handed off the leadership to a local Cambodian team, and they're now running it because they understand Cambodia in a way that I, you know, just couldn't as a foreigner.
Yes.
And I think that's one, you know, really important part of the story to avoid the groupthink is for that foreign founder to step away.
You've touched on something very important there, is that there's a local in the mix. Because in a lot of boards for charities, like, there's no locals, right?
No.
So they're making decisions about local things, but none of them are from the area.
Yeah.
That's critical, isn't it?
It's critical. It's also kind of common sense. I mean, I'm really amazed that in 2023, we still need to have this discussion.
Yeah.
If you look at bringing it back to Australia, there's the big foundations who give out the vast majority of money philanthropically in Australia have boards that are very monochromatic. They don't look like modern Australia. They're the usual suspects in terms of what you might see on a board. And when you close your eyes and think of a board, unfortunately, that's what you see. And it's not representative of the people that we have in Australia and the problems that these people face, particularly in marginalized communities.
Yeah.
And so I think, again, it's when this comes up over and over again, it's you sort of roll your eyes a bit and you think, surely we're past this. But unfortunately, it's still something we need to talk about. Representation matters.
Yeah. Well, it's just because they're just coming at it from a perspective of the people as well. You know, like, you can't spend all day in boardrooms and expect that you understand.
Yeah.
And something else you touch on too is the sort of grassroots charity versus the big wheel type charities. Little charities are, you know, person on the ground type stuff. You're really connected to the things that you're solving. Whereas if you are sitting in one country making decisions for a different country, just that disconnect, right? There was another part of this which I was going to ask you. Tell me about Umbo. What does Umbo do?
So Umbo is something, after I came back from Cambodia to Australia, and I was quite burnt out, by the way, but after I recovered from that burnout, because, you know, handing off your work to local Cambodian people, it's something I absolutely agree with, but then there's a whole separation piece there for me to get over that separation. And then what I realized was that there are people in Australia who also lack access to services like speech therapy and occupational therapy, but they're just geographically located in regional communities.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
So the wait times for a lot of these services, which are urgent, are 18 months as an average.
Yeah.
Sometimes 5 years. I've heard 8 years someone waited to get speech therapy, which is insane and really unacceptable.
What's the point?
Yeah, what's the point? You know, this, and Australia, by the way, I think second most developed country in the world from a stat from a while ago probably, but, you know, very, very advanced country, and yet some people just don't seem to get access to things that they should be. So Umbo is not a charity. It's a for-profit, for-purpose entity. It's a social enterprise, and all of the services that we deliver to people in regional communities are online. So we do online speech and occupational therapy.
Like telehealth type.
Telehealth,
yep.
So 60% of our clients are regional, 11% are Indigenous. And apart from the client base that we serve being those who really need the services, also 50% of our profit goes into a social impact bank account. And that money is used purely to help people when they can't afford to pay for the service.
All right.
So, you know, a single mother who's a refugee background will come to us and say, you know, I need to get some assessments done for my two children who may have autism, and then we will pay for those services for her, and that money comes out of the profit that we make, 50% of it.
Yeah.
So it's a really beautiful model because unlike charities, it's actually supposed to grow.
Yeah.
The more we grow, the more people are served, the more 50% profit we can use to give people free healthcare.
Yeah, which is a very different model. Yeah, that's right, because a growing charity is really just it's sort of self-serving, isn't it? It's growing to...
Growing charity is a failing charity, in my opinion. But, you know, a successful charity is one that winds down and gets smaller and smaller as it solves the problem.
Yeah. Now, you've done something else with OIC. You've created OIC Australia. And I believe, and you can correct me here, but I believe that that exists to fund OIC Cambodia.
Yeah.
Do you want to explain that model briefly? Because I've heard of this before and it's actually quite clever.
So the key thing is that OIC Australia is as you said, there to fund but not tell OIC Cambodia what to do.
Mm.
So, you know, a traditional model of charity might have a headquarters in Brussels, for example, and then the local chapter of that charity is in Kenya. And you've got the headquarters that are kind of like directing traffic in a certain way and certainly holding that Kenyan office accountable and making sure that they're doing the right things. But I think this is sort of the opposite of what I think is successful in terms of structure. So OIC Cambodia is the charity that's implementing, run by Cambodian people. OIC Australia is here purely to support, purely to fundraise. And we do this really cool thing called Day Without Speech, where you've got school-age kids, Andy, you would probably like this one.
Yep.
We get kids in schools to give up talking for a part of the day.
How much of the day?
Your kids at their age all day?
Yes.
Young kids, even as young as four, I believe, have done 45 minutes of no talking.
Okay.
And they experience what it's like to have a communication difficulty. And of course, they fundraise for this charity in Cambodia.
Ah, so they have to go about their day.
They have to go about the day.
But using, they're not allowed to talk.
Yeah, using whiteboards, using facial expressions, using hand.
Anything else.
Signals, anything else.
Yeah. That's really interesting. Do you do, how often do you do that?
Well, certain schools do it every year.
Okay.
Yeah. And the older kids who are, you know, 10 and 12 can do it all day.
Right. And so that's this is a regular thing that you do and that's a fundraiser.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really clever. I quite like that.
Well, it's not a hard sell. When you go to a school and you ask the teachers, no, hey, would you like your kids to not talk for the rest of the day?
For the whole
time. Most teachers are pretty much on board from day one.
How many times a year should we do this fundraiser? Yeah.
How many times a week should we do this?
That's really good. So the whole idea is it's a separate business that raises funds to help the charity operate, but it doesn't tell the charity how to spend the money. And probably it's worth mentioning why it's important that they don't tell them how to spend the money.
Yeah, well, it comes back to that point about the local people being in positions of power. You know, we in Australia don't know what's happening on the ground in Cambodia. We don't understand the needs. And so while we can set the framework up and I can, as the founder, set up this exit goal of 2030 and 100 speech therapists, how we get there is not really my remit. So I think it's really important that we give up that element of control and put the people in positions of power who do understand.
Yeah. And you're saying it's probably better to get out of there sooner than later as well.
As a founder.
Yeah. Even if you're not quite ready?
Yeah. This is a really tricky one. As a founder, when is the right time to leave? And, you know, it's hard to have hard and fast rules about when in terms of time periods. But I think earlier rather than later is better. You know, I think founders are, you know, and I'm multi-founder, if that's a word, founded a few things. We're interesting people. We're certainly part and parcel of being a founder is, I think, the ego and the mindset that I know better, in essence, right? What you're essentially saying is there is a gap here that I've got a model which is going to be better than the existing solutions.
Yeah.
And that's great. But with that comes a whole bunch of other problems because sometimes implementing that vision in terms of day-to-day stuff isn't necessarily the founder's strength, you know, and in Cambodia, this is a really obvious example. I'm not Cambodian. I can speak the language, but not that well. So that's when it's important to know when to leave as a founder and to hand off that work.
Yeah. Speaking the language is a big one, isn't it?
Hmm.
There's a fancy word, I think, which I can't remember what it is, but it's something around tourism volunteering.
Voluntourism.
Voluntourism. What's voluntourism?
So voluntourism is the combination of volunteering and tourism.
Yep.
So it's when you take a trip to be in another country and volunteer. And inherent in that is the idea that you don't have deep knowledge of that place. You might come into Guatemala for 2 weeks and you might, you know, volunteer in an orphanage or something along those lines.
Yep.
And that's very surface level stuff. What's interesting about this is that so many tourists have this experience and then realize it's not actually that helpful.
Uh-huh.
They come out of it feeling a little bit empty and they think about, you know, well, did I actually do anything useful for those people in those countries? Because I was only there for 2 weeks and I'm not sure about my long-term impact.
Yep.
There's actually a really great story. There's an American lady who volunteered in a country somewhere in South America, and what they did was they built a library for this orphanage. And these are people like me who don't have hard labor skills. And she woke up in the middle of the night and she heard this clanging noise. And what it was the local men were actually taking apart the wall that they built brick by brick and reassembling it overnight. And of course, in the morning, the whole-
Because it was poorly built.
Poorly built. Structurally unsound. And then you go, what is this? Like, how does this whole charade exist? And it kind of shows you the madness that the local people are like, let's bring in these people to make themselves feel better about themselves and, of course, bring money and resources in.
Of course.
But actually what they're doing is a complete shambles.
That's crazy.
Mm.
So they're rebuilding the wall. I can see where the tourism stuff would come in, and I can see why it may be considered useful because, we're funding an area. We're funding a community at the same time as doing some good. But just doing something because someone tells you it's a good cause is one of the main messages, isn't it? It's you have some questions, which are the themes of this book around the good cause. What are the questions people should ask about good causes?
Yeah, well, when someone says it's for a good cause, you know, think about the person who's bringing the chocolates to the office to fundraise that, or the person on the street who's asking for your money.
Yep.
The implication is it's worth supporting.
Mm. You
know, I think this is a very Australian saying as well. I think I haven't really heard it overseas, but it's for a good cause.
Mm.
And then we all be like, okay, yeah, we should definitely support it. But the problem with this, of course, is that we then take out that critical thinking aspect. We don't ask those difficult questions about what makes it a good cause. So I think some of the questions worth asking are, you know, what's the end game of this cause and how do we know when the problem is actually solved?
Yeah.
You know, and when will the charity finish is another really good question to ask.
Yeah, that's a unique question that I don't know if anyone asks ever. Mm.
It's not common.
No, because I don't think most people would think charities should finish. I think they would be not thinking that way of thinking, which again is, like I say, this is challenging. This book is challenging because it does make you go, I've done this.
Yeah.
I've done this in the past.
When you bring up the idea that charities should end, there's a bit of like, a feeling of like, but how can it? Because things are so bad. You know, there's so much poverty and there's so much inequality. Charities surely can't finish. The part of the answer to that is charities do finish. Sorry. They do close doors. They do exit countries. It happens anyway.
Mm.
So there's a study that looks at what are the two key reasons why charities pull out of other countries like Cambodia.
Yep.
And the first reason is the donor government, let's say the Australian government that gives the money, no longer gets along with the host government, the right. Cambodian government, for political reasons.
Yep, yep.
The second reason is the charity runs out of money. So it just, you know, can't fundraise enough to sustain the project and it has to withdraw. There's no alternative. Now, neither of these reasons are internal reasons. These are all externally things that happen to us as the charity. So what happens is the charity pulls out and the work they've done and the impact they've had just falls over. And my argument is, well, if this is going to happen anyway, why don't we set up our own exit intentionally? Why don't we be, you know, the captains here where we actually say, we're going to end at this time and therefore once we finish, the community that we're working with will be set up to do it themselves.
Yeah. And then they can, yeah, exactly. Then they can sustain the activities that you created through the charity. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's a great concept. If nothing else, it's worth thinking about. Because it has been mentioned actually, Louise Larkin, which is a couple of podcasts ago, well worth a listen. She has friends, she has a charity and she has friends who often say to her, I want to create a charity. And she says, well, you know, like, why do you want to create a charity? Why do you want to do that? I think it just comes from a place of people wanting to do some good, you know, it's the good cause.
Yeah. And I think, you know, people wanting to do good, first of all, is fantastic. And, you know, when we see a particular problem, we are driven by our emotion to act. And that's part of being human. That's perfectly reasonable. And if we weren't emotionally affected, we'd have to question whether we're psychopaths or not. So I think we all feel that emotion and the need and urge to do something. And then we take an action.
Yep.
But in between the emotion and the action, there's a moment there that really determines how successful the outcomes of our action will be. It's that moment of critical thinking, you know, do I need to create another charity or are there already so many charities in Australia working on the cause? Should I maybe research what they are doing and maybe assist them? you know, or maybe asking another question, when is this charity going to end? Those sorts of critical questions that some people never really get around to, or they get around to too late maybe, they really determine the success of our action.
Yeah, 100%. The book here, well, I'm going to hold it up. So if you're listening to this, you can go and watch the video on YouTube, but I'm going to hold the book up here. It's called Redundant Charities by Wei Yeo. It's got a little hamster on the front, which is quite appropriate, isn't it? It's an excellent book.
Thank you.
Not a huge read, not real long, but it's packed. And there's some great examples of charities that have successfully become redundant, which they're really valuable lessons, because without those, I think it's a little bit, it sounds too hard to do.
Yeah.
So there's some really good examples in there. So I strongly recommend it. What's the best place that someone can get a copy of your book?
Yeah, they can go online to redundantcharities.com.
Yep.
And they can either get a hard copy or a ebook, and all the different places that are selling it are linked into that.
Sure. Is there an audio version?
It's coming.
Coming.
May I borrow the studio?
Yeah. You come and record it here.
Yeah, it's coming. It takes time.
Yeah, it does take some time. Again, it's an excellent... You got any other ideas for any other books?
I do, actually.
Yeah?
So, yeah. You know, and just to go back to this book, like, I think it is really important that as much as there are a lot of criticisms of charities, there is a hopeful message through these types of charities that I highlight in the book, that there is a way to do this, I think, that actually makes sense, and a structure that suits what we're trying to achieve.
Yep.
And these charities that I interviewed for the book, they're just so inspiring, because everything they're doing goes against those incentives of ego, of self-perpetuation that we discussed in this episode. So I think following on from that, I'd like to see maybe a book about what I call catalytic charities. So charities that are catalyzing change. So again, they're not the ones that are saying, give me X and I'll do Y. They're actually saying, give me X and I'll create X, Y change for someone else to carry it on. I think there's also a concept I'm interested in about redundant leadership as well. So leaders who make themselves redundant and who are judged by not just their time in tenure, but also what happens after. There's a very interesting case study, Alan Joyce, I beg your pardon, of Qantas would be a great case study. I'm just waiting to see how things play out a little bit more. And yeah, so, you know, what he did when he was CEO of Qantas versus the impact afterwards, you know, are we measuring the right time frame when we're measuring success for that kind of leader?
And leaders creating leaders.
Leaders creating leaders.
Which I've seen a few times lately. It's a bit of a topic. Redundancy is your theme by sounds of things. I look forward to if you create any more work. If you jump on your LinkedIn, like, you've got a lot going on.
Yeah.
So I don't know how you find the time. You've got a TED Talk as well, which you can find. Where can we find the TED Talk? Where would you look?
Probably the easiest thing is just to Google my name and maybe the title. But so my name is spelled W-E-H and the last name is Y-E-O-H.
Yep.
And the title of the talk is Why International Charities Should Make Themselves Redundant.
Yep.
So that was a few years ago. It's very much, if people didn't want to read the full book, that will give you a bit of an insight into
the
logic. Gives
you an insight, yeah. It's a great topic. And I congratulate you on doing this. And like I say, yeah, it's a great read. It's a great read, especially if you're someone who's a bit like a giving kind of a person and you want to, you've thought about it yourself, or even if you've got a charity. If you've got one now and you know, you want to think about how to take it to not the next level, you know, it's the opposite, isn't it? Listen, Wei, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been a great chat, and I'm really wishing you all the best for what you come up with in the future in OIC Cambodia. And I hope you get out of there soon.
Thanks, Andy. I really appreciate you having me in the discussion too.
No worries. This has been the Good People Podcast. My name is Andy. It's all brought to you by In Other Good News. If you like what you're hearing, make sure you tell a friend. Tell a friend about our podcast and let them know what we're all about, because there's some great stories on here. People like Wei, who generously give up their time to tell us about what they do. The other thing you can do is on the app that you're listening to this on right now is you can subscribe to the podcast. Put it in your library. Again, it helps us out so much. We've had a fantastic year here at the Good People Podcast. So it is getting towards the end of the year. Not to date stamp us too much here because all of our content is fairly evergreen, but please make sure you tell your friends. But also, thank you so much for tuning in, and we will catch you in the next season of the Good People Podcast. Wei, thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Andy.
It's a tip of the cap, it's a pat on the back, it's a smile from ear to ear. They're the good people from round here. They're the good people from round here. Come on, let me introduce you to a few.